This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The UK's digital tech scene is accelerating, and the proof is in the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. This year, we celebrate the next generation of pioneering startups that are shaping the tech landscape of tomorrow. The UK is a thriving ecosystem with access to global talent, cutting-edge research, and unparalleled investment opportunities. Your big idea belongs here. Visit great.gov.uk/UKPA to learn more.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On today's edition, China is reporting its biggest ever trade surplus, nearly $1 trillion more sold to the world than China imported. And this just a week before Donald Trump's inauguration and potentially more huge US tariffs on Chinese goods. Also today, why money troubles are now the number one anxiety for young Australians, and remembering Olivieri Toscani, the legendary Italian art director who launched many of Benetton's most controversial ad campaigns.
I believe he was fired by Benetton twice for creating controversial messaging. However, I don't think he went too far. I personally don't think he went far enough because his advertising worked.
More of that later in the show. First, though, our main story today. Lebanon's president has today confirmed the appointment of Nawaf Salam to be the country's new prime minister. The decision was announced by the director general of the Lebanese presidency, Antoine Choukair, at a news conference. Well, this announcement follows a decisive vote in Mr. Salam's favour in the Lebanese parliament. The armed faction Hezbollah has backed another candidate in this race to become the prime minister, but the former caretaker PM did not succeed. So this appears deliberately aimed at excluding Hezbollah from power. Months of fighting with Israel have weakened the armed faction, as well as the fall of its powerful ally Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Some say this could mark a turning point as well in the prospects for the country's economy, which has seen a dramatic collapse and a banking crisis over the last 5 years. I've been speaking about that with Aline Kamakian. She's a restaurant owner in central Beirut. I began by asking her if she had lost money in the crisis.
Oh, yes. I lost my saving. I lost the saving of the restaurants, and we had to start all over again. I started from the bottom line again.
How much did you lose?
Above $2 million dollars.
$2 million US dollars?
Yes.
Wow. And that was just because of the collapse of the value of the Lebanese currency. It was all frozen in bank accounts.
Exactly. Frozen bank accounts, and, you know, it's no more bank that they didn't open, your credit card, your bank.
Will you ever see that money again, do you think?
If things are in the right direction, and if we are working back, and if Lebanon is safe and people are coming back, it's a saving of 10 years, you know. I hope I will get back. I'm always on the positive side, and I like to work, and I didn't give up. And not a single Lebanese actually gave up. We are very much into working and this style of people. We are, sometimes it's a, we say it, it's a double-edged sword, you know, being resilient or being positive or continue to live. It's a double-edged sword, because if we had to fight the problems from the beginning, maybe we wouldn't be this long suffering from our main problems.
Are people eating? Are people eating out?
People are eating out. We had a bit of diaspora people coming on the Christmas, so it was a good business. And things are changing, and hopefully for better. I'm not saying that everything is solved, everything is happy, nothing, we don't have problems. No. It's filled up the problem, but at least we have a light end of the tunnel.
That's Aline Kamakian, owner of Myrique Restaurant in downtown Beirut. Well, I've also been speaking about all of this with Diana Menhem. She's a former economic advisor at the UN Resident Coordinator's Office in Beirut. I asked her first how the economic collapse had come about.
What happened was that, first of all, the Lebanese pound depreciated massively. It lost more than 95% of its value. So people lost their denominated savings, but also they lost access to their accounts. Lebanese banks are actually bankrupt. So what we're living with today is zombie banks with depositors still being unable to have access to their money, except for a very small amount, by virtue of a decree that was issued by the central bank.
Right. So essentially, you and other activists blame the ruling elite for allowing this crisis, or certainly allowing it to persist for so long.
First of all, for allowing it to happen, because this was a massive Ponzi scheme whereby very high interest rates were being paid in order to attract foreign currency into the country, while at the same time there was no ability to repay or protect the dollars that were coming into the banking system. And also, of course, for allowing it to persist for this long. What they did is try to delay reforms, kick the can down the road, and refuse radical reforms because these reforms would actually be impacting their own interests.
So we've now got the new president in place, Joseph Aoun, and he has appointed with the lawmakers Nawaf Salam as the new designated prime minister. Mm-hmm. What difference will this make?
First of all, the good news is that we have a new prime minister who is outside of the system, who comes from outside of the system, who is not part of the deep state or the establishment, so as to speak. The president himself has laid out a very ambitious reform project in his inaugural speech, and this also makes us very hopeful. He has committed to reforms that the Lebanese have been waiting for a very, very long time.
Is there evidence that this could happen? I mean, there have been false dawns before, haven't there, for Lebanon?
I mean, well, we're going to have to wait and see. But yes, definitely trust in the upcoming prime minister, Nawaf Salam, to enact these reforms is 10 times higher.
What I can tell you is that there's already confidence in the international markets. Lebanese Eurobonds, which were trading at 6 to 7 cents a dollar a week ago, jumped to 16 cents a dollar after the presidential elections. So this already gives you a feel of the level of confidence in the international market and how this has shifted post-presidential election.
This is all you're saying because Hezbollah, who used to be the kind of power broker in Lebanon, no longer has the political leverage it used to have over the lawmakers.
It's not only Hezbollah. It's Hezbollah, but also a web of interests, of businessmen, of bankers, of politicians.
A month ago, you told the Financial Times that the war at that time was a final nail in the coffin of the country's economy. Do you think now maybe it's been a blessing in disguise for bringing this political revival?
I mean, war is never a blessing in disguise. I mean, people are still out of their homes. We've lost so many lives. But I think today, with the reconstruction, we have an opportunity. And I think that today, the Lebanese more than ever do not want to engage in wars anymore. And I think these two factors will hopefully allow us to rebuild bigger and better in the upcoming phase and to reposition Lebanon in the region. The Lebanese are tired of being aligned with an axis that actually has done nothing to the country but bring war and destruction.
The axis being Iran and Hezbollah.
Yes, the axis being the Iranian axis in the region and Hezbollah being part of it in Lebanon.
The former UN economic advisor, Diana Menhem, speaking to me from Beirut. China has today reported its biggest ever trade surplus just a week before the inauguration of Donald Trump. He has, of course, promised to impose tariffs on Chinese goods. China's exports last year were nearly $1 trillion more than the country's imports. Here's the trade minister, Wang Lingzhen.
The total import and export value last year reached about $6.1 trillion, up by 5% year on year, setting another record high. China, as the largest trader in goods, has further consolidated its position.
Well, he may sound buoyant about this trade surplus, but of course, coming just days ahead of Donald Trump's inauguration, it could spell trouble. He has promised up to 60% tariffs on Chinese goods, threatening an ever greater trade war. Chinese producers, meanwhile, appear to have stepped up exports to offset the sluggish domestic demand that's taking place in China itself. Here, households are still struggling with the effects of a three-year property crash. I've been speaking about this with Desmond Shum. He is himself a former property developer in China. He mixed in the highest echelons within Beijing before he left the country in 2015. I asked him why China has such a lack of demand at home.
When Mao first established China, the communist control of China in 1949, that's the reason why China's manufacturing is like 35% of global manufacturing. I mean, one third, more than the EU and the US combined. And domestic consumption is weak mostly because the Chinese household income as a percentage of GDP is less than 40%. It's 39-something. Let's say compared to the UK. UK is about over 70%, just over 70%. I mean, there's a wild gap in how the economy is structured. So the consumer not spending money in China because they don't have money to spend. That's why the consumption is weak.
Especially not now with the property market collapsing, right? I mean, that has been a big hole in the pocket of many middle-class Chinese people.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think that is the reason I am actually very pessimistic about the Chinese economy for a long while. I mean, being a developer myself in real estate myself in my previous life, the real estate is really beyond salvation. After years of contracting, and the contraction has been going on 20 to 30% year on year over the last 3-4 years. We just have too many houses, too many apartment blocks, and it's not an issue, a cyclical issue. Say that's a dip, that the developer has a cash flow issue. If the government rushes in, the industry will bounce back. No, we just have built too many stocks. It's just too many stocks in the market, and then the social wealth effect on the households because the collapse of the real estate market is just starting to ripple through. This is very early stage of the wealthy playing out.
Really? You think this is just the beginning?
Oh, this is absolutely the beginning. I mean, it's every major luxury brand see their sales in China being the drag. Every luxury brand last year have double-digit decline in China.
Is there any sense of a policy response to what you're describing in Beijing by the leadership? I mean, for the last 2 or 3 years, we've been discussing this sharp slowdown in China's domestic economy. Is there any way out of it for the government?
It's really difficult to see a way out. So I just talk about real estate. I think the real estate market is beyond salvation. Every real estate developer is essentially bankrupt. They are insolvent. But the only reason they haven't collapsed is the government doesn't allow creditor to claim assets on this bankrupt developer. The issue to readjust the economy is a structural issue. And then you need to change the structure. The world recognizes, including the bureaucrats in the Chinese government, recognize consumption needs to be a bigger part of the story for the economy to rebalance itself. But if you want the economy to rebalance itself, the household income has to really come up. But when a household come up, then the government have to take less, the business need to take less. So structural reform will induce political change. And for Xi Jinping's China, he sees that as too risky, too painful. It's exactly the opposite direction he wanted.
You know Xi Jinping, you've met him. You don't think it's possible that he could change?
He spent the first 10 years to consolidate power and also driving China to a direction he thinks is right. He said, well, I want to take China to this direction. Unless I consolidate power, take out all the rival, and I can be one-man show, I cannot drive China to that direction. But now it turned out that it's the wrong direction. So how do we unwind this thing? That's not who he is. It's very, very difficult to switch. But beyond the point, you know, this is not what he will leave.
And he would have to admit he was wrong. to
do. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And for a dictator, that's about the most painful and probably most costly thing that can happen.
The former Chinese property developer Desmond Shum speaking to me earlier. Now joining me to discuss this and other news, our regular markets guest Peter Jankowskis of Arbor Financial Services in Chicago. Hi, Peter. So China's $1 trillion surplus there, I imagine that that is going to be fuel for the hawks in the Trump administration when he takes office next week, calling for tougher tariffs.
I'm sure it will. You know, it's going to be a focal point for them to point to that and say, you know, look, they're basically taking the manufacturing that could be taking place elsewhere around the world.
How is Wall Street pricing in the risk of this, though? Because everyone is saying that that could be hugely inflationary, particularly if those tariffs are extended to other countries like China and Mexico and the European Union and so on that he's talked about. How do they price that in?
Well, I think the market is very sensitive to interest rates and inflation, though they're not really focusing on the tariffs as a source for it. You know, you can see that sensitivity in what happened in the U.S. market on Friday with the tremendous sell-off on the stronger-than-expected jobs report. You can see that extending even in today's, people talked about a rally, but the rally was really more in industrials. The tech sector, which is very interest rate sensitive, was still down today. But they haven't necessarily associated with China yet. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, just you mentioned this, so I just want to flesh that out. Strong jobs figures on Friday, as you mentioned. Comments as well from the Federal Reserve, perhaps, pushing bond yields ever higher. Now, I mean, some people are saying this could mean there is simply not going to be any Fed rate cuts at all in 2025. Is that right?
That is correct. That's what people are speculating now. So in the course of just a couple of months, we've gone from people expecting 4 cuts to 2 cuts and now no cuts. So that is definitely going to be putting more and more pressure on equity valuations here.
And as you say, no pricing in as yet of tariffs if they come. I guess the markets are just gambling that Donald Trump is talking more than he means.
Yes, I think many people are seeing the talk as a negotiation point, a negotiating tactic, and it remains to be seen if there'll be follow through on that.
Okay. Peter Jankowskis, thank you very much indeed. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Cost of living pressures have overtaken climate change and the environment as the number one concern for young Australians, it seems. It's according to a national survey from the Christian charity Mission Australia. It's the first time that financial pressures have been the main issue in the annual youth survey report, which surveyed 17,400 Australians aged between 15 and 19. From Sydney, Phil Mercer now reports.
If you don't have a roof over your head, you don't have a home type of thing. And that comes first before an issue like climate change.
Making ends meet is a constant struggle for Piper and her flatmate Callum, who are university students in Sydney. They both work long hours, but after paying for rent and food, there's not much left.
It's a lot of planning to try and, like, keep up with your own wage because, like, you don't really know, especially being a student and being casual, you don't know what you're going to get every week.
Honestly, I think the hardest part is splitting up your paycheck and then realising that you don't have pretty much any money to put away for a rainy day fund or for travel or for something that you want to save up for, like a car. It's less of a stress and more of just a dread.
And those fears are shared by 17-year-old Ruby, who's about to leave home for the first time.
I do think that I'm going to have to work very hard to keep affording rent and everything and food and everything on top of study.
The number one concern for young Australians is the cost of living. That's overtaken climate change and the environment.
The annual survey by Mission Australia, a Christian charity, sought the opinions of more than 17,000 teenagers and young adults. Crime and mental health are key concerns, but for the first time, economic anxieties are top of the list.
Sharon Callister, Chief Executive Officer of Mission Australia. Young people are having a tough time. They are facing cost of living pressures just like the rest of the community. And if you're looking to get where's your next meal or am I going to have a safe roof over my head tonight, then clearly you can understand why climate change isn't the number one priority. Doesn't mean that it's not important for them, but they've got more urgent issues that they need to be considering.
Unlike their parents, many young Australians are entering adulthood with a sense of trepidation about money. What should be carefree days of starting work or study have become far more serious. Stuart Jackson is from the University of Sydney.
It means that people's vision for the future has been shortened to the next 2 weeks. It means that people aren't thinking about, well, where will I be in middle age? But it does mean that they've shortened their horizon. It's not, I'll finish my degree and then I'll get a good job. It's, I have to think about getting another job now to be able to pay my rent, or I will have to go down to a food bank to try and get some food. That's a really shortened horizon. It means people don't look to the future. So politicians who talk about visions for the future are not speaking to them whatsoever.
It's important that, you know, this group enters the labour force as strong as possible. And that's, you know, for today, but also for the future.
Angela Jackson is an economist. She worries that many young people are starting their working lives feeling apprehensive.
So we know that, you know, labour force scarring is a real concern when, you know, you have a generation that's entering into the labour market during weaker economic times. That can have really long-term repercussions in terms of the earnings of that generation and of that cohort.
With an election looming, many young Australians will be voting for the first time and will have their say on efforts to ease cost-of-living burdens. In Sydney, I'm the BBC's Phil Mercer.
Well, tributes have been paid today to Oliviero Toscani, the Italian fashion photographer who's died aged 82. He's renowned for the provocative images he used in Benetton's advertising campaigns. For 2 decades, he was the art director of the global clothing chain. He made a career out of images on themes like ranging from HIV/AIDS to racism to the death penalty. Carrie Jacobs was the founding editor, along with Oliviero Toscani, of a magazine that Benetton produced in the early 1990s. She told the BBC about the day that she was called into the office of the editor-in-chief to look at some of Toscani's images.
Look through these photographs and tell us which ones you think are the most shocking. So I was sort of sorting them into 2 piles, like horrific and not horrific. And the ones that were in the horrific pile, like one of, it was like a mafia hit car bomb, and the one of the man dying of AIDS, those are the ones that became the ads. I didn't always agree. I was kind of horrified when I realized that the ads that I put in the this is too grotesque pile were the ones that wound up in the ads. But I think that he had the trust and the assets for a long time of Luciano Benetton and was able to do these projects.
Carrie Jacobs recounting her work with Oliviero Toscani. Well, earlier I spoke to Carl Jones. He's a former advertising executive himself, now a senior lecturer in PR and advertising at the University of Westminster. I asked him to recall the impact that Toscani's Benetton campaigns had.
It was a campaign that was global, and it was even in Times Square in New York. I remember seeing it. Basically, they had the different ads that they would select and then just expose them across the world through various mediums like magazine, outdoor, newspaper, wherever they could reach their target market.
How did they change what we were used to, what the norms of advertising of that time?
When they came out, there was no such thing as brand activism. And so Benetton was the first brand to start introducing human causes into their messaging. All other clothing brands and other brands were just doing regular advertising. And Benetton was the first one that was making a statement regarding stuff that would appear in the news. So there was a very famous ad where they had a man who was dying of AIDS surrounding by his family. And that ad caused a lot of controversy globally, specifically in America, because the word AIDS had never been mentioned by the president. So what was great about Benetton is that it was giving a voice to people that needed it. Benetton also had ads that that were controversial regarding racism. They had one that had three hearts, a white heart, a black heart, and another heart. It was just trying to get across the idea that we all have the same blood and we all have the same heart on the inside.
And they were taking a stand, as you say, on things that perhaps now would seem less extraordinary and controversial, maybe were more so then. But do you think a cynic would say they were just out to shock for the sake of shocking because that worked?
Their brand was speaking on behalf of issues that were very controversial, and this was their tactic. And they did this for many, many, many years. Currently, there are brands that do that, and they only do it so they can sell product. Whereas Benetton and the art director, he created messages that really resonated with people. And I think that their messaging was to create conversation and also to get the brand noticed and to sell sweaters. But it was really part of their brand DNA. It was really that the brand cared about these news stories that were happening around the world.
You were an advertising exec at the time. Did he influence you?
Yes, I was definitely influenced. I'm an art director background, and he was an art director. He was creating messages that spoke to me and represented what I felt. And so, yeah, he was very controversial and influential with many people who were starting in advertising at that time.
I mean, one of his images was the Pope kissing an imam, I believe, on the lips. It's the kind of thing that was going to shock Catholics and Muslims. Did he ever go too far?
He did, in terms of his bosses, because I believe he was fired by Benetton twice for creating controversial messaging. However, I don't think he went too far. I personally don't think he went far enough because his advertising worked. When you create controversial messages, you're also discussed in the news and through public relations. So you're getting more bang for your buck in terms of getting more people exposed to your message, because advertising normally is paid for. Whereas what happened with the Benetton ads is that many newspapers discussed him and people around dinner conversations talked about him and the Benetton ads. So it was getting free advertising.
Former ad executive Carl Jones recalling Oliviero Toscani. This has been World Business Report. From me and the rest of the team, take care.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.